Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Just minutes ago, Dan Rather signed off as CBS Evening News anchor 24 years after taking the chair. With a nod to his early years as anchorman, he offered his final words in that role.
Not long after I first came to the anchor chair, I briefly signed off using the word courage. I want to return to it now in a different way. To a nation still nursing a broken heart for what happened here in 2001, and especially to those who found themselves closest to the events of September 11th. To our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in dangerous places. To those who have endured the tsunami, and to all who have suffered natural disasters and who must now find the will to rebuild. To the oppressed and to those whose lot it is to struggle in financial hardship or in failing health. To my fellow journalists in places where reporting the truth means risking all. And to each of you, courage. For the CBS Evening News, Dan Rather reporting. Good night.
Dan Rather went out at a tough time for television network news and for his own reputation after controversy over CBS reporting on President Bush's National Guard service last fall. But Rather's place in media history goes back to his days in Vietnam and as a White House correspondent, and not just one of the crowd there. He had a reputation as a journalist unfazed by the powers that be. Here he is in a Dukes Up news conference exchange with President Richard Nixon in 1974.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
The fact that Rather leapt from Washington reporting to one of the most visible jobs in journalism was not surprising. It's the same route taken by Walter Cronkite, Tom Brokaw, Eric Severide, and many others. After all, the Washington Press Corps works at the center of national policymaking, of breaking political news. It is the heart of America's news media. And this evening, we look at how that heart is doing. Tonight on Point, the legacy of the Washington Press Corps and the job the news media in the nation's capital is doing today. You can join the conversation. How do you rate the press coverage out of Washington these days? Is the country getting what it needs? Is it getting a clear, honest view of what's going on? Is it any better or worse today than it's ever been? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Donald Ritchie. For almost three decades, he's been Associate Historian of the United States Senate. His new book is Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. Donald Ritchie, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
So, Donald Ritchie, here we have just seen and heard a moment in passing history, Dan Rather taking off from this scene. You've looked all the way back to the 30s and the life of the Washington Press Corps. I just wanted to begin with, there's a lot of history we want to hear tonight, but what are your thoughts as Dan Rather goes off into the history books, at least as far as his anchorman role goes? How do you see him?
One of the remarkable things is he's the only third anchor that CBS has had since there's been television news. It was Douglas Edwards and then Walter Cronkite and now Dan Rather, who's had 24 years. So it's a remarkable amount of continuity, and it's questionable as to whether anyone in the future will be able to hold on or whether even the network news will survive in the form that we think of it.
We're going to talk in more detail about that later in the hour. We're also going to hear later in this hour from Jay Rosen at New York University about the job that press in Washington is doing today and what's ahead for that press and what Americans can expect from it. But Donald Ritchie, you've looked back very richly at how this press corps developed and the kind of waves of style and posture that we've seen from the Washington Press Corps. I wish you'd sort of take us back and remind us that this was not always the premier place for American journalists to be. In fact, it was considered a bit of an exile post.
Yes, I began my book in 1932 at a time when newspapers like the New York Times were having a hard time getting their senior reporters to come down to Washington. They had to twist a lot of arms finally to get Arthur Kroc to come down temporarily in 1932. He wound up spending the rest of his life in Washington, but it was not considered a great duty assignment. Reporters would rather be in Chicago or in New York where the action was, and Washington was sort of a sleepy town. Walter Trohan, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, said you could read a newspaper in the middle of any of Washington's avenues and never get run down by a car, and that gave a sort of an idea of what they thought they were coming to. Same thing with foreign correspondents. They really covered Washington and the rest of the country from New York City, not from Washington in those days.
When you hear Americans complain about the coverage they get out of Washington today, and as you write, the complaints come from many directions, from liberals who think it's too conservative, from conservatives who think it's too liberal. But when you hear the tenor of complaints abroad in the land right now, how do they fit in with your understanding about how Americans have seen the press there over the 70-plus years you looked at it?
Well, I found that Americans have always tended to criticize the press. H.L. Mencken was saying really nasty things about the Washington Press Corps back in the 1920s and the 1930s. Nothing worse than you'd read today, I suppose. But it certainly has changed, and the Washington Press Corps has evolved enormously. I think Washington Press Corps today is far superior to the press corps that you would have seen in the 1920s and the 1930s. And it's also far more diverse. It was essentially just newspaper reporters in 1932. And now, of course, we have broadcast and we have electronic media. There's a lot of competition among the media, and it's a much larger field of reporters than existed in 1932.
It was FDR's administration in the 1930s that really created the era of the Washington Press Corps. How did that come to pass, Donald Ritchie?
Well, before 1932, only when the Congress was in session was there any news coming out of Washington. And newspapers wouldn't even pay their reporters to be here when Congress went out of session. So the reporters would, for the most part, go home when the Congress adjourned, which was after about 6 months in the city. And the White House just didn't generate enough news to sustain reporting all year round. The wire services would cover the White House during the off months. Franklin Roosevelt made Washington news a 12-month-of-the-year job. And he certainly brought attention to what was going on in the government. Everybody wanted to keep up with the latest bills coming out of the White House and going down to Congress, these major New Deal initiatives. Roosevelt himself was a very dynamic person. He held twice weekly press conferences during his presidency, packing reporters into the Oval Office, bantering with them, arguing with them, denouncing them at times, laughing with them. But he certainly caught them up and got them into the excitement of what was going on in Washington and really just changed the whole tempo of the news.
So the press corps drawn in by FDR to cover the New Deal's creation, the creation of big government, I guess it would be called. And now that press corps still sitting there as George W. Bush comes to the podium with proposals that he likes to describe as turning all that around.
Yes, and of course we've had the last 20 years of presidents who've been telling us that the era of big government is over, although government continues to grow in that era. We've had situations in which the White House press corps and the rest of the Washington press corps has actually been somewhat devalued by their bureaus. The bureaus in Washington in many cases are smaller today than they were, say, 20 years ago. CBS's Washington bureau is much smaller than when Dan Rather took over, for instance, in 1980 and 81.
You remind us that the standard or the goal of objectivity didn't always come with the package in Washington. What was the origin of that sort of approach to news, to be objective?
Well, if you go back to the 19th century and you picked up any newspaper, you could tell from the front page whether it was a Republican paper or a Democratic paper. The reporters tended to write the party line. And in many cases, the newspapers were owned by the parties or the party leaders or the senators who were representing the state. In the late 19th century, commercial advertising took over, and editors tried to take opinion out of the news, and they began to build a firewall between their editorial pages and their news pages. Lots of correspondence between editors and their Washington correspondents saying, "We don't need your opinion. We'll make up our own minds about this. You just tell us what's happening. Give us the facts." And in the 20th century, the ideal is objective reporting, in which reporters report both sides of the issue. But at the same time, there are certain reporters who are given a license to have opinions. They're the columnists, the syndicated columnists who become very popular starting in the 1920s and on. And then other reporters who are allowed to have a certain amount of news analysis that's clearly marked in the newspapers. But there's certainly a great deal of complaint that opinion and analysis has crept over into the news columns itself from time to time. And part of that is the fact that reporters are human beings. They have opinions about what's happening. It's very hard for them sometimes to suppress their opinions, especially if they feel there's a strong moral issue, a civil rights issue, for instance, or the anti-war movement that was going on, or some other issue that really catches them up, and they slip over from objectivity into advocacy.
Of course, the other side of that, Jack Beatty, is that the press is often charged today with having become a kind of echo chamber for official policy or the official view of the world, whatever that may be, a kind of megaphone for those in power.
Well, that's true. And it was said during the Clinton administration by one class of outraged voters, and today by another about Bush. But, you know, the president and press have always been bound in a kind of hostile dependency, like a bad marriage. You know, they're yoked together, but in a kind of hostile way. And presidents have really distinguished themselves in the degree that they have handled this and indeed managed the press. I mean, witness Nixon's trials with the press versus JFK's almost effortless managing of the press, managing them so successfully that Tom Wicker, who covered the White House under JFK, recently told me that he didn't know, nor did he, from his observation, did any other reporter know, either of the extent of John Kennedy's illnesses, the, you know, the pharmacopoeia of pills he took every day, or of his sexual dalliances. Not a word of that was known, he says, among the Washington press corps. And years later, he put that to Pierre Salinger, JFK's press secretary, and he says, well, you know, we didn't want you guys to know any of that, and we kept it away from you. Well, that's managing the press.
Of course, there's the question of what we don't know today. Jack Beatty, Donald Ritchie, please stand by. We're talking tonight on the day Dan Rather has signed off about the heart of the American press in Washington, D.C., and what kind of job it's doing bringing the country the news. You can join the conversation. How would you rate the Washington Press Corps today? Is the country getting what it needs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dan Rather has signed off as evening news anchor for the last time. And on this day, we're looking at the heart of the American press in Washington, D.C., and what kind of job it's doing bringing the country the news. My guest tonight, Donald Ritchie, is author of the new book, Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. You can join us as well. Is the press any better or worse today than it ever was coming out of Washington? Is the press too much like a White House megaphone? Is it a propaganda tool? Is it too critical? Is it not critical enough? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Donald Ritchie, you quote Helen Thomas, of course, the longtime UPI reporter, and for others as well at the White House, when she sat down with you, having come from an Easter egg hunt on the White House lawn where the president had been roped off from reporters, and she said to you, they'd put ropes around our necks if they could get away with it. That being the attitude of the White House toward reporters over a long time in many administrations. I wish you'd give us a sense. Jack began to wade into how different presidents saw the press and interacted with the press. Walk us through some of that history, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, right on through how different presidents have brought out the press' best qualities or co-opted or been adversarial with the press.
I begin in my book with Franklin Roosevelt because he realized the editorial pages were stacked against him. They all endorsed his opponents. And he felt that he could really win over public opinion if he could win over the press corps, the working reporters. And he socialized with them. There were hot dog parties for the reporters on the White House lawn and at Hyde Park. And he also traveled by train, so there was long stretches in which reporters could socialize with him. They played poker with him. There was a lot of interaction with the president that really is really off limits today. Harry Truman was very much the same. The first day that Truman was president, he left his apartment. He saw the Associated Press reporter that had covered him in the Senate standing on the street corner, and he said, you know, what are you doing here, Tony? Get in the car with me. And he drove him to the White House that morning. So there was a lot more intimacy. Eisenhower had played golf with reporters before he was president, but he stopped once he became president. And the reporters wondered what was up about that, and they decided maybe it wasn't. They played pretty poor golf. But Eisenhower kept his distance. He really felt he was the general and they were the lieutenants, and they weren't going to fraternize at that stage. Kennedy had been a reporter himself. He'd started out as a newspaper reporter in 1945. He'd reported for the Hearst newspapers. He was pretty good at it, actually, when, you know, according to the other reporters, except that he didn't want to be an observer. He wanted to be in the thick of the action, and he ran for Congress then in 1946. Mm. But he liked reporters. He socialized with them. Some of them were his closest friends. He liked to gossip with them. And I think there was a great give and take. He was very accessible during the 1960 election. By contrast, Richard Nixon running against him was very aloof from the press. Nixon didn't like reporters, and they got that message very clearly. And there was always a great hostility between Nixon and the press that ultimately worked to the president's detriment. Kept them at some distance, but now the press secretaries are sort of a great cordon around the presidents.
We often hear that it all changed during the Reagan administration. There was a lot written then about how the Republicans had figured out how the American press worked, and they were having it dance to their tune very effectively. Did you see a watershed there?
Well, President Reagan's training was as an actor. The first time I ever saw him on the Capitol lawn, and when he was running in 1980, it was a large setting that they were taping television commercials. And he was the only one who was in character during the whole thing. I was very impressed. He was very professional. He didn't have to know all the information. He misspoke constantly at press conferences, and they were always having to issue corrections the next day. But he looked so good on camera. And his White House press office realized that if they had him give a speech in front of Mount Rushmore or the Statue of Liberty, he would send a message of a strong presidency. And so there was a heightened packaging of the presidency that came about during his time that I think other presidents have tried very much to follow.
Clinton was genial but had a pretty tough time at a number of points with the press.
Surprisingly, I think the assumption was that the liberal media would be sympathetic to a liberal president. And in fact, the matter is Clinton had a very hostile and rough time often with the press. Part of that was when he came to Washington, he felt he didn't need the press corps. He could talk right over the tops of their heads. He could go on Larry King's program, and he could use the new media. It didn't work for him. And in fact, every president ultimately needs the press corps to get their message out.
And now put George W. Bush in that context for us and how he relates to the press, how his administration is succeeding or failing in using the press. I guess all presidents try.
Every president has tried to talk over the tops of the press corps, in some degree going back to Franklin Roosevelt with the radio, that they always felt that the press is trying to filter what they're saying and that the public is only getting part of the story, which is quite true. The fact is that the public doesn't want everything. They want somebody to make sense out of this great mass of information that's coming out. And so presidents have, even though they have had a chance to speak directly, President Nixon certainly made a lot of use of television addresses to the public, but it was still the press corps that shaped the public image. And I think you'll see that in this administration, the second administration of the Bush administration, that you'll see a certain point in which they'll have to use the press corps more than perhaps they would like to.
And analyze what you see going on in Washington today through the prism of history that you've put together here. Do you see a more or less skeptical press, a more or less probing press, more or less aggressive? You get complaints from both sides, from different political vantages here. How do you see what's going on today, Donald Ritchie?
A lot of the veteran reporters talking to me told me that the turning point in many ways was the U2 event in 1960, when they suddenly realized that Eisenhower had been lying to them about what was going on. They'd been issuing false statements. And you get these constant shocks, the same in the Kennedy administration, when one of Kennedy's aides said that the government had the right to lie. During the Vietnam War, when Lyndon Johnson established the credibility gap about what he was saying. During the Nixon administration with Watergate. And each of these turned the press corps a bit cynical about politicians. And so you have, in many ways, a much more skeptical questioning of the politicians afterwards. The other hand, to balance it, is that the reporters need these politicians, and they need people in the administration to provide them with information. And if you're a Washington reporter, you really need to develop inside sources. And that does tend to blunt some of the things that you write, because you can't offend your inside sources. They'll never talk to you again. So there's always that tug of war between the skepticism and the cozying up, in a sense, to whoever happens to be in power at the time.
You say a more skeptical press for some years now, but yet we had some of the major press organizations in the country, big newspapers offering big apologies after the invasion of Iraq, saying they just didn't get the story. They kind of followed hook, line, and sinker what had been put out there, and it was wrong.
Oh, yes, of course, the same organizations got it wrong at the beginning of the Vietnam War as well, and partly it was because they accepted what they were hearing, And partly one of the problems in the more recent period is that there was a, during the 1990s, a cutting back of news from Washington. You saw less news from Washington on the front pages, less of it on the evening news. There was much more reporting about the supermarket than about the Pentagon. Much of that changed in 2001. A lot of those bureaus are now being augmented again. But many cases, they were unprepared. There are actually fewer foreign correspondents representing the networks right now than there were, say, 25 years ago.
Jack, you've looked into this history as Donald Ritchie's put it together, and you've watched plenty of it. How do you see what's coming out of the Washington Press Corps these days? Is it, you know, a time of riches, a time of famine, a time of tough inquisition, or the opposite? How would you frame it?
I tend to come down on it. It's been too easy, but then that's a function of my prejudices, I think. You know, what I'm struck with is the shrewdness of the Bush administration. They, for all that, you know, conservatives complain about the press, the president has been very effective, it seems to me, in using it, and so have his aides. I mean, there have been well-timed leaks, for example, the Valerie Plame leak, which discredited or was used to discredit a CIA officer and or her husband, really. And other, you know, other leaks from administration officials that have really had the effect of shaping the climate for the president. So yes, he's gone around the press and he said, I don't want to deal with you people. I'm going to talk to the people out in the hustings. But he's also, I think, and his aides especially, have used the press to had trial balloons, to shoot down people they don't like, to. You know, in short, as a kind of way of communicating with the public and with their base.
And yet, I see even beyond that kind of use, the White House putting out a very strong vision of the way the world is, and many Americans saying, "Wait, who's supposed to check the big vision? Who's checking on that?" Let's turn to our callers here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Anon is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Anon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is basically this, that it seems that a lot of the reporting that comes out of Washington is basically reporting what both parties said about a certain issue as opposed to actually doing any kind of in-depth analysis. And I'm just wondering, has it always been the case or is it just a fairly recent phenomenon?
We'll pick it up, Anon. Thanks, Donald Ritchie. What about it? Has it always been he says, she says? You know, Republicans say this, Democrats say that. You figure it out?
Well, there's all different types of reporting. There are certainly the PAC reporters. Their job is to get the he says, she says, and to go back and forth and interview both sides and to do that. There have also been a long history of investigative reporting, the people who dig beneath that, who don't accept the press releases, who don't go to the press conferences, but who walk the corridors of the agencies and talk to some of the lower-level bureaucrats who actually know what's going on and are willing to say things, at least off the record, as to what's happening. So there's a certain amount of digging that's going on, but certainly the basic story, the objective reporting, requires reporters to accept what the politicians are saying, but then to look for their opponents and to try to come up with some sort of a balanced view of it.
But do you think that sharp red-blue America map makes reporters more timid about moving away from this just straightforward, you know, stenography, he said, she said, because they're afraid to run into trouble with one side or the other of the political divide?
The interesting thing about the Washington Press Corps is that they're a very collegial group, and they do work as a pack, and you do see reporters all standing together outside of the door. But the fact of the matter is every one of them wants to beat everybody else in the pack, and everybody wants the scoop. That's what makes people's reputations. And especially if you're in Washington, you want to do something that's different. That's how Dan Rather came to public attention as a CBS reporter. He always seemed to find something that everybody else didn't know. And that's what irritated the White House quite a bit when he was a White House correspondent. So reporters are collegial, but they're also severe competitors. And what I found when I was interviewing a lot of reporters was the stories they loved to tell were not the stories in which they pinned the politicians' ears to the wall, but when they beat out the competition, the other wire service or the other newspaper or the other broadcast network. Those are the things that they remember the best.
But whether that's the dynamic that really gets us to the heart of what's going on in this country, in this world, may be another question. Donald Ritchie, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Jay Rosen. He's Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University and author of What Are Journalists For? Jay Rosen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm reading here, Ken Auletta talked to Dan Rather before for the New Yorker before Dan retired, and he had Dan Rather saying, "The one thing I hope and I believe is that even my enemies think that I am authentic." Frank Rich looked at that and said, the New York Times columnist said, "The bar is so low these days that authenticity may well constitute a major journalist accomplishment in itself." Jay Rosen, do you see the bar having fallen so low in Washington? What's the quality of reporting you see coming out of the Washington Press Corps?
Well, I think the Washington Press Corps is at a very confused point in its history, where it is still lodged in the White House and still very much organized around the president, and yet the White House, I think, has undertaken to completely excise the press from the presidency, has begun to marginalize it and intentionally alienate it. And so the Washington press faces a kind of challenge in a way, but it's not prepared to act in a tit-for-tat manner, but it's being played politically. And I think it's a culmination of a long period of change, but the Bush people have figured out essentially how to sideline the press and make it less important and make it not just manipulable, but entirely negligible, and that's a different thing.
And what's the impact of that on what Americans come to understand about their country and the world?
Well, what it really means is that we can't really believe any longer that the press stands between the president and the public. That really is not the case. You could be better off imagining it perhaps in a side room where the president occasionally comes in and talks to it, but that notion that the press interprets, or that the White House has to go through the press to get its message out, I don't think describes our political life anymore. And so there are many more ways in which the White House can speak to the American people. It's not just a fantasy. It's true. The whitehouse.org gets you to the American people. And so journalists have to figure out a different role when they are no longer the gatekeepers they once were between the president and the public.
Jay Rosen, what about these specific things that have come up in this presidency, this kind of counterfeit newsman phenomenon that we saw with James Gannon or Mr. Guckert, in fact,
yes.
The notion of paid news figures, Armstrong Williams and others who apparently took money from the government in one way or another to support government policy, the subpoenaing of news people related to the Valerie Plame case, who are now looking at jail time for keeping confidential sources. How do you interpret what's going on with this cloud of developments?
Well, this is something that I think makes the current era a little different than previous administrations, where, as we've said, there's always been a desire to manage the news, always been this tension. There's always been a war with the press, in a sense. But right now what we have is that plus a cultural war going on, in which the discrediting of mainstream journalism is itself a political project that gains the American right wing a lot of traction and a lot of excitement and momentum. And it has cultural causes that are totally independent of the White House. And yet, these two things work in tandem. And the culture war is discrediting the press while the White House is avoiding and marginalizing the press. And at the same time, because of the internet, there's like a new press coming in to the picture. And that's why this is such a high-stress but also fascinating period in Washington journalism from my point of view.
Donald Ritchie, give us your historical perspective. Jay Rosen says a discredited press there by design. Do you see it as discredited compared to other eras?
Well, of course, Richard Nixon tried very hard to discredit the press in his period, sending Spiro Agnew out to attack the motives of the major broadcasters and others at the time. But there's always been a tension in the press in Washington about who is actually a legitimate reporter, and this goes back into the 19th century. It goes back. It comes right into the radio era. It comes into the electronic media. This latest controversy in the White House is a playing out of an old story in some respects, which is that the politicians are very happy to open the doors to anyone who wants to write about them, especially if they're going to write about them in a favorable way.
But this is more than opening the doors. This is opening the wallet.
Oh, exactly. But this, I'm thinking about the accrediting somebody who was not accredited by the press themselves. the press have always been much more restrictive. And in fact, the press have always had a lot of difficulty admitting that a new form of technology can actually do legitimate journalism. So print reporters held back on radio for a long time. And right now, both the broadcasters and the print reporters are having a terrible time trying to figure out, are web reporters really legitimate reporters? It's not surprising that the web reporter would get a better friend, in a sense, in the administration than it would be from the press corps.
Always resistant to the new technology representatives coming in, though we heard just a few days ago the first blogger with his press pass to the White House. Donald Ritchie, please stand by. Jay Rosen, Jack Beatty. We're talking tonight on the day that Dan Rather has signed off about the heart of the American press in Washington, D.C., and what kind of job it's doing, bringing the country the news. You can join us tonight. What do you think of the way the Bush White House uses the press? Have you been scandalized by reporters being secretly paid on the side by the Bush administration? Do you resonate with Dan Rather's parting warning of an intimidated press? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the heart of the American press in Washington, D.C., and what kind of job it is doing bringing the country the news. Dan Rather has signed off for the last time. You can sign into this conversation. What do you think? How would you rate the job the Washington Press Corps is doing today? Is the country getting what it needs? Is it getting a clear, honest view of what's going on in the country? What's going on in the world? We're joined tonight by Donald Ritchie. He's in Washington. His new book is Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. And from New York by Jay Rosen at New York University. He's author of What Are Journalists For? Also the author of Press Think, a weblog about journalism and its ordeals. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Jim's calling from Boston. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily an original thought, but going back to your original question at the start of the program, the American people get every night we get about 16 minutes of real news.
You're talking on the major networks or ABC, NBC, right. CBS evening news.
Regardless of whether it's Dan Rather or Peter Jennings, mm-hmm. How much real information, how much useful information can be conveyed to us in the time that they give to us?
I've lived
overseas for extended periods, and they devote full hours with in-depth reporting, a lot of international news, but our news standards are pretty low, I think.
Jim, is of course, the answer to that these days would be, hey, there's 24-hour news all over the place out there. Does it really matter if those three networks just give you 16 minutes after commercials?
That's a fair point, but at least as far as the major networks are concerned, I think that they're in real trouble. If that's going to be their format going forward, I don't think that they have much of a future.
Jim, thanks for your call. Jay Rosen, how about it? The nozzle on the hose is too small. Americans aren't getting what they need, and yet our caller says, and yet there's all that news pouring out over cable television. How do you see the quantity issue?
Well, you have to distinguish between acts of original information extraction mm-hmm. and the inflation of that information by talk into more and more discussion. Those are two different things that are going on in news.
No kidding.
The new formula for news is to spend very little for actual new information and to play it through a lot of formats and guests and political perspectives and generate your 24 hours that way. So 24 hours doesn't mean that much more news. And this is the concern with the decline of the network news broadcast is investment. It's declining investment. More time, but less investment.
Donald Ritchie, do you agree? Do you see it as kind of devolving into a gab fest with not the real stuff in the pipeline of shoe leather news reporting?
There's an awful lot of opinion that's being presented as news these days, and opinion actually can be very provocative and it draws an audience, and so you're going to see more and more of it. It's happened especially since the Fairness Doctrine was done away with by the Federal Communications Commission, and when the government no longer sort of expected a lot of public service from its broadcasters. So it's been a steady decline in hard news and a steady increase in the amount of people talking about what they think the news is.
Jack Beatty, and yet there's so much out there. After September 11th, we were, all promised that we'd be riveted to the news evermore to find out what was really going on in this world. You'd think a strange time not to want to dig into the news when it's clearly so deep and vital.
Yes, but at least as it comes to you on television, it comes as blather, especially on the cable news channels, just endless blather. I mean, and the one of the arts of television news was to tell a story in pictures, to have a narrative. The reporter would give you an image, would carry the story along. And that itself had a kind of aesthetic pleasure, but it also made sense of things, because stories have to make sense of things. Well, the blathering talking head makes sense of nothing. There's nothing is shaped so that even the kind of local illusion that you understood something that you got from a story, maybe from an image in the story, maybe from a live, real person being quoted, that's out the window with this cable news thing, which is just the endless parade of coiffed talking heads blathering.
Well, there we go. Coiffed talking heads. Karen's calling from Linfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi, Dick. How are you? Calling
Tom, thanks.
My question is a little bit about the readers, the quality of the readers, or the quality of the listener. I mean, that's got to have been changing as well as the quality of the reporting. And I was wondering, I know that if you used to, 10 years ago, you used to talk to people and everybody would get the newspaper and be reading it as a matter of course. And the more you ask now, the fewer people just have it as a regular habit. So, I mean, sort of the habit is not only that there's so much more information, but there are people less inclined to kind of go to the information. And I was wondering what your guest had to say about that.
Jay Rosen, do we get the news we deserve?
I think there's some truth in that, but just to complicate it a little bit, there's certainly way more information now, and people don't have the same habits they once did. The newspaper habit in particular is disappearing. Part of the reason for that, though, is that professionals have arisen who tell us that they are monitoring the world for us, and we kind of rely on them. And so there's a division of labor that's involved as much as let's say, a faltering will to know. However, when political life becomes serious, we see that Americans are desperate for information. And that is sort of where that urge to be informed went. It's in reserve. It's there. It's waiting. But the job of journalism and politics and people in our business, this business, is to engage people, you know, all the time in the problems of the world. And that's not a hard, easy thing to do. There's lots of things pulling against it today. And it's a different world than when everybody got up and read the newspaper in a sort of regular fashion. But media is going to be part of life more now, and more people are going to be making it, and it's going to come from more directions, and there will be more producers trying their hand. And so we may figure out this puzzle.
Donald Ritchie, do you see the echo coming back from the public to what's put out by the Washington News Corps as different today from in earlier eras?
Well, the news media is always shaped by cultural forces. And, you know, one time the afternoon newspaper was the most profitable of all the newspapers because that's what people read on the trolley going home after work. And it was essentially put out of business by television news in the evenings. The afternoon newspapers pretty much don't exist anymore. Now the Internet, to some degree, is challenging the television's primacy. And quite interestingly, the Internet is now putting out a PM edition on many of the newspapers because people at their desks at work are turning to the Internet. A younger generation of news seekers are going to new forms of technology. You can tell by the commercials on the broadcast news that it's a very older generation that's watching watching the news these days.
But in effect, a new afternoon edition coming out with those afternoon online updates that the big papers do. Federico's calling from Boston. Hi, Federico. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. First of all, congratulations on your program.
Well, thank you very much.
My comment is this. My recent feeling has been that the media, and this relates more to TV news than to printed media, probably,
okay. Mm-hmm.
has become more and more of an outlet for the centers of power. And let me be precise about this. I don't just mean that, yes, the media in general has to be balanced and report the Republican side of an issue, the Democratic side of an issue, and so on, but that when one side of an issue is factually wrong, it ought to be challenged. And that's not what I'm seeing when false or incorrect facts are coming out of the White House or the Pentagon.
It's just not happening. Federico, our time is short, but let me pick that up and give it to Jay Rosen. Jay, what about it? Do you see, we asked Donald Ritchie earlier, but in this politically polarized time, do you see journalists as less willing to step up and challenge because they maybe see as taking sides?
Less willing, yes. Less able, and in a weakened condition to insist on fact. I don't think they really have that power anymore. And this is one of the stranger things that's happening. The weakening of fact sounds like it couldn't happen. It sounds like too crazy or science fiction.
Surreal, yeah.
But I think there's a sense in which that is happening today. What it means is there's more freedom to sort of invent political reality today. And maybe there's something good in that, but there's certainly something troubling for a lot of people in that. And it does have to do with how much can you get away with in stretching the evidence, cooking the books, advancing the case beyond what is known, pretending to be certain when actually you cannot be. And if the room for that expands, then what you're really saying is that you've built more lying into governing than we had before, and that's the risk that we're under.
And Jay, you talk with reporters who are working now in Washington. When you talk with them, do they agree? Do they feel that they can't insist on fact, an oxymoronic kind of thing for a journalist to say? Do they agree with you?
Actually, there's a contingent in journalism who are very concerned about this and don't know what to do with it. And they call me, and they just basically call me to talk because it's not like it's an immediate issue. It's an ongoing issue. And I think they're puzzled by the attacks on them. They're puzzled by their ineffectiveness, and they're puzzled by what kind of response can you have to tactics like this. And I think it's appropriate that they're puzzled because this is a new set of problems, and they're scared, some of them. And during the election, especially in the weeks leading up to the vote, there were people who were frightened in journalism by the kinds of tactics that they were seeing, the kinds of attacks that were coming on them, and also the difficulty of knowing where it was coming from.
And that, going right to Dan Rather's observation, there's a threat of journalists being widely intimidated. Donald Ritchie, we've just got half a minute left here, but when you look against the backdrop of history, do you see a danger of the Washington Press Corps kind of turning a corner into an era of invention where they're disempowered, they can't insist on fact, and all the reporting coming out of there, you know, declining in its value because of that?
No, I don't. I think they have James Madison to thank for that, because our system of government is a divided government. The White House can't control everything. There's a Congress, and that's where a lot of good news from Washington comes from, the people who really want to talk.
So they've got the bully pulpit at the White House, but watch the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and pray, maybe. Donald Ritchie, Jay Rosen, grateful to both of you for being with us tonight. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Donald Ritchie, author of the new book, Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps, and Jay Rosen at New York University, author of What Are Journalists For? Jack Beatty, last word goes to you. You turning your TV on tonight?
I am, but you know, the thesis that reporters are afraid, take a look at the Social Security debate. The Bush White House said, don't call it private accounts, call it personal accounts, and they all did.
Boom, done. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Okay.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a look at the future of network television news. This is On Point. Dan Rather's sign-off earlier this evening and Tom Brokaw's retirement from NBC in December have reshaped the faces of network TV news, and as many are questioning its future, brought many questions to the fore. Ratings for the big three network broadcasts have declined steadily since the 1980s, and the average age of their viewers has now reached 60. Joining me to look at the future of network TV news is Jack Schaefer, editor-at-large at Slate.com. His latest article looks at CBS and asks what the networks should do in the post-Rather era. Jack Schaefer, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you, Mr. Ashbrook.
I wish you'd take us right down through your laundry list. What are you suggesting for CBS Evening News?
Well, I would suggest for all the news networks that what they're essentially selling now are buggy whips in a day of cars. You know, I think they're very passe. They're very close to being as nostalgic to many of your listeners is maybe newsreels, because fewer and fewer people are watching them. So CBS's problem is greater simply because they're in third place. But at a certain point, I think all of the networks have to realize that they need to make a broadcast for a 21st century audience.
So you say CBS News has got an atrophying and doomed broadcast niche. Take us through your laundry list of how you would remake it.
Well, I've got a couple of suggestions. First off, I think CBS should target serious news consumers. The people who are most loyal, the devotees who followed breaking news all day on radio and cable and the web. I dedicate the program, their program, to the breakingest of breaking news. Next, reduce the number of commercials. I watched the CBS Evening News tonight and clocked in like 7.5 minutes of the 30 minutes were commercials, mostly for medications for old people. I think that really interrupts the program, makes it too short for it to be compelling. They would lose some revenue, but I'm sure that if they said, look, CBS News gives you 2 more minutes of news per half hour, it could be a real selling point.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is, I think TiVo and other technologies, podcasting and soon-to-come video podcasting, have destroyed the concept of appointment viewing. It used to be that people would reliably be queued up to their televisions, watch the television programs when the networks wanted them to watch them. And I think that's been absolutely shattered, and I think it'll be shattered for radio as well. CBS should respond by putting all of their broadcasts on the web, make it so that viewers can build menus or watch what CBS wanted to put up. They could also, broadcast it in a more convenient time slot. 6:30 or 7 o'clock, depending on where you view the CBS News, is way too early for the way that 21st century people live.
It's the old Leave It to Beaver time slot.
The Leave It to Beaver time slot. So I would suggest that until the future comes where they're streaming it on the web or making it available video podcast, that they strike up a partnership with somebody like CNN and build a sort of refreshed CBS Evening News at 10 o'clock when people put kids to bed and have the dishes done and are ready to attack some real news.
So there's your laundry list. What's your sense of what CBS is likely to actually do in the weeks and months ahead?
I have probably as good an idea about that as you do. I think that it would require somebody who was a real television revolutionary to come in and shake things up. In my piece, I said what CBS needs to do is, without subscribing to the news values of Rupert Murdoch, they need to ask themselves, what would Rupert Murdoch do? He's been an incredibly inventive and clever broadcaster over the years. And I'm not saying that CBS should tilt right wing. That's the last thing that I would have them do.
But you mean think like a rebel. That's hardly their reputation at the moment.
Exactly. And so what you've got is sort of three network broadcasts sort of stumbling in a sort of doomed fashion, dwindling, and I think that you'll have to see perhaps heads roll at CBS before you see anything really exciting and innovative and worth watching.
So the revolution maybe not imminent yet. We'll watch this space. Jack Schaefer, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Ashbrook.
Jack Schaefer, editor-at-large for Slate.com. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skoke, Michael Garth, Mike Toda, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.